Trump had tweeted about. And although I was banned from FBI property, I had a copy of my unclassified memo about his request stored securely at home. Tuesday morning after dawn, I contacted my good friend Dan Richman, a former prosecutor and now a professor at Columbia Law School. Dan had been giving me legal advice since my firing. I told him I was going to send him one unclassified memo, and I wanted him to share the substance of the memo, but not the memo itself, with a reporter. If I do it myself, I thought, it will create a media frenzy, at my driveway no less, and I will be hard-pressed to refuse follow-up comments. I would, of course, tell the truth if asked whether I played a part in it. I did. I had to. To be clear, this was not a leak of classified information, no matter how many times politicians, political pundits, or the president call it that. A private citizen may legally share unclassified details of a conversation with the president with the press, or include that information in a book. I believe in the power of the press, and know Thomas Jefferson was right when he wrote, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." I don't know whether the media storm that followed my disclosure of the February 14th "Let It Go" conversation prompted the Department of Justice leadership to appoint a special counsel. The FBI may already have been pushing for the appointment of a special counsel after seeing the Trump tweet about tapes. I just know that the Department of Justice did so shortly thereafter, giving Robert Mueller the authority to investigate any coordination between the Russian government and the Trump campaign and any related matters. I also don't know whether the special counsel will find criminal wrongdoing by the president or others who have not been charged as of this writing. One of the pivotal questions I presume Bob Mueller's team is investigating is whether or not, in urging me to back the FBI off our investigation of his national security advisor, and in firing me, President Trump was attempting to obstruct justice, which is a federal crime. It's certainly possible. There is at least circumstantial evidence in that regard, and there may be more that the Mueller team will assemble. I've prosecuted and overseen many cases involving obstruction of justice, but in this case, I'm not the prosecutor. I'm a witness. I have one perspective on the behavior I saw, which, while disturbing and violating basic norms of ethical leadership, may fall short of being illegal. Central to the question of obstruction, for example, is a showing of President Trump's intent. Is there sufficient proof that he intended to take those actions and others to derail a criminal investigation with corrupt intent? Because I don't know all the evidence, I can't answer that question with any certainty. I do know that, as of this writing, Special Counsel Mueller and his team are hard at work, and the American people can have confidence that, unless their investigation is blocked in some fashion, they will get to the truth, whatever that is. On June 8, 2017, I testified publicly before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which wanted to hear about my interactions with President Trump. For whatever reason, the president had only increased people's interest in my perspectives. I decided to write an account of some of my dealings with him and submit it in advance to the committee so that I wouldn't need to speak for a long time at the start of my testimony, and to give the senators a chance to digest what I wrote and ask follow-up questions. I wanted to use my brief opening statement to accomplish one thing, to say goodbye to the people of the FBI, something President Trump did not have the grace or charity of spirit to allow me to do. It also allowed me to deny, on their behalf and mine, the lies the administration had told about the FBI being in disarray. I knew they would be watching, and I could speak directly to them. I practiced what I wanted to say in front of Patrice and one of our daughters. They were shocked that I intended to speak without notes, but I told them it had to come from the heart, and that if I brought a text, I would end up staring at it. As nerve-wracking as it was to speak without notes in front of millions of people, that was the way it would mean the most to the people of the FBI. Patrice was also concerned that in my nervousness I would smile like a fool or frown as if someone had died. I had to find a place between those two. I questioned my decision to go without notes as I stood in a conference room waiting to walk into the Senate hearing room. What if I freeze? What if I get all tangled up in my words? I don't normally get nervous in public, but this was nuts. But it was too late. I walked with the leaders of the committee down the long private hall behind the dais, turned left, and stepped into something surreal. I have seen lots of cameras in my day and heard my share of shutter clicks. nothing compared to this scene. As I sat at the witness table in the eye of the storm, I kept hearing Patrice's voice in my head. Think about the people of the FBI. That will bring light to your eyes. And so I did. I stumbled a bit and nearly lost control of my emotions at the end when speaking about the people of the FBI, but I spoke from the heart. I said this. When I was appointed FBI director in 2013, I understood that I served at the pleasure of the president. Even though I was appointed to a 10-year term, which Congress created in order to underscore the importance of the FBI being outside of politics and independent, I understood that I could be fired by a president for any reason or for no reason at all. And on May the 9th, when I learned that I had been fired, for that reason I immediately came home as a private citizen. But then the explanations, the shifting explanations, confused me and increasingly concerned me. They confused me because the president and I had had multiple conversations about my job, both before and after he took office, and he had repeatedly told me I was doing a great job and he hoped I would stay. And I had repeatedly assured him that I did intend to stay and serve out the remaining 6 years of my term. He told me repeatedly that he had talked to lots of people about me, including our current attorney general, and had learned that I was doing a great job and that I was extremely well-liked by the FBI workforce. So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation and learned, again from the media, that he was telling privately other parties that my firing had relieved great pressure on the Russia investigation. I was also confused by the initial explanation that was offered publicly, that I was fired because of the decisions I had made during the election year. That didn't make sense to me for a whole bunch of reasons, including the time and all the water that had gone under the bridge since those hard decisions that had to be made. That didn't make any sense to me. And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me, and more importantly, the FBI, by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I'm so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them. I worked every day at the FBI to help make that great organization better. And I say help because I did nothing alone at the FBI. There are no indispensable people at the FBI. The organization's great strength is that its values and abilities run deep and wide. The FBI will be fine without me. The FBI's mission will be relentlessly